there was an enormous crowd. There are two times in my life where the police had to come and redirect traffic because there were so many people on the street, and that was the first time. But also what happened is because there was enormous crowd of people. I'm in a tiny railroad apartment.
Right.
I don't know that there's all these people outside. I'm on the fifth floor. I'm not looking out the window. I'm like, you know, having fun.
Right.
But apparently the hallways were completely jammed the whole way up. People went all the way up to the roof, and the roof was jammed. And then outside of the apartment building, I was on a bus lane.
Mm-hmm.
The police came and they had to redirect the buses. So out in the middle of this opening, this older Ukrainian guy shows up and he said, "I'm your super." I was like, "Really? First time I've ever seen you."
Right.
And he said, "You can't do this anymore."
Mm-hmm.
And he was right. I mean,
yeah.
It was ridiculous.
Yeah.
It was totally ridiculous.
This is The Conversation. It's episode 205 with Gracie Manchin. She is a legendary former art dealer of most notably the East Village, also Soho and Chelsea. And she is currently a specialist in contemporary art for ArtNet Auctions. If you are unfamiliar with the East Village art scene of the 80s particularly, and 90s to some extent, this is a great time to get caught up on that. I missed the East Village art scene, and it's not so much the specifics of the art that we get into so much as the art scene, the very DIY, go with the flow, very intimate community-based art world of that time that we talk about and give you a nice taste of. Before we get into the later years, the 90s and the 2000s and so on, up to now. I'm Michael Shaw. The website for this podcast is theconversationpod.com. And just to give you a heads up, speaking of the website, if you go to theconversationpod.com/support, you can check out the t-shirts that are only going to be available a little bit longer. I think this is going to be a first and last run of the t-shirts. So I will tell you more about those on the back end, but wanted to give you a heads up. If this is something you're curious and intrigued about, go to that page, theconversationpod.com/support, and have a look there. I'll tell you more about it on the back end. I'm also going to tell you on the back end about Happy Place, which is something that is maybe the apotheosis, maybe the jumping the shark of the selfie space movement that's going on these days. I'll tell you a little bit about that as well. We have a lot to cover in this conversation, so let us not waste another moment and get into that right now. Thank you very much for being here. If you're new, welcome. And I will talk to you more about so many things on the back end. Talk to you then. You know, out of instinct, I pictured when you said my friend next door said I could come over, I just kind of pictured like the house one driveway over. But you probably went several blocks by city standards.
No. It is. I mean, I did exaggerate a little bit. It is one driveway over, actually.
Right. Okay. And can we say where you are?
Yes, we're in Hampton Bays.
Hampton Bays. Okay. I don't know if I've been through that part of the Hamptons in my very brief ventures out there. And
it's the Unhampton.
The Unhampton Hampton? Right. Okay.
Yeah. It's actually between Quogg and Southampton.
Okay. Okay.
But
is that
nobody knows about it, and that's fine with me.
Yeah, yeah. Is that more on the away from the ocean side?
No, it's right on the ocean.
Oh, it's right on the ocean. Uh-huh.
And in fact, the difference between Hampton Bays and the other Hamptons, well, not all the Hamptons, but let's say West Hampton and Quogg is in Southampton, and from there on out, is that we don't have houses on the ocean. The ocean is all national park lands. So it's fantastic. It's just dunes and oceans and no house.
That sounds great.
So all of our houses are on the bay. My house is close to the bay.
I see. Nice. And how long have you been going out there?
I rented it for 25 years, and then I bought it in 2000. I bought it at the height of the market, 2008.
Uh-huh.
Unfortunately.
Oh, I'm sorry. You know, one of the things that I wanted to ask you about, since I knew you were going to be out there, is our mutual connection, Jimmy Dams, the artist and now gallerist for many years. I can't remember if he said he has never been out to the Hamptons or he's been out there once, but I take it you've invited him and he has declined, right?
He's been out here once.
Right.
Yeah.
Got it. Okay.
Which is funny, but he can come out anytime he wants. I have, you know, a 4-bedroom house. There's tons of room for him. And,
right.
And, but he's, you know, I think being out in nature makes him nervous.
Was your original impetus for getting out of the city for the natural reasons, like, you know, to get a little solitude and peace and quiet, or how do you describe it?
Absolutely. That is exactly why. When I first started coming to the house, it was in 1986, I think.
Wow.
85 or 86. And 85. And it was, you know, my weeks were just crazy. So coming out here was like the only way to really get away from it.
Yeah. Are you still in, as far as where you're based in the city, are you still in the East Village area?
I am.
Mm-hmm.
Still there.
Yeah. So, I mean, between going out to the Hamptons for this many years and being in the East Village for this many years, I mean, where do you even begin to talk about the changes? And I mean, I talk about this all the time with people towards the beginning of the show, you know, gentrification and changes and, you know, with New York guests and so on. And I don't want to belabor it or, you know, or make you sort of go through like the talking points about it, you know, to be too predictable. But let's just put it this way. What are your takeaways generally as far as the changes over the years?
The changes are massive. When I moved, and it affects the art market and it affects artists. I think rent is, you know, the biggest problem in New York City for everyone, for the galleries, for the artists. When I moved to New York, my first apartment cost me under $100 a month.
Wow. That's phenomenal.
And when a second apartment became available in the building, mm-hmm. I said, I'll take that. And so I had a studio and I had an apartment for about $200 a month.
Right.
And that was fantastic. And that, in fact, is where my first gallery was. It was the apartment was a fifth floor walk up, and that's where it all took place.
What was the location?
It was on 9th Street between 1st and Avenue A.
Okay. One of the things that comes to mind when you mentioned the, you know, ridiculously low rents of that time is what is the downside? I mean, you know, certainly New York in the late 70s, early 80s was not only very different, you know, market-wise, but also safety-wise. I mean, to what extent was that something was an issue for you?
It wasn't an issue at all. It was a great thing. I'm not exactly sure what you're asking. I mean, I moved to the East Village because that's where all the artists were, and that's where a lot there was a large immigrant community, and it was at the time that I moved there a drug haven. So there were apartments were very inexpensive. People didn't want to live there. And as a matter of fact, not only did taxis not want to bring me home at the end of a night, which they would say, I don't want to go there. Are you sure you want to go there? You know, and this was only Avenue A.
Right.
But to get a taxi, I had to walk to Second Avenue because there were no taxis that were in that neighborhood. So that's changed.
Yeah.
You know, enormously. Now on Avenue C, there's, you know, $6,000, who knows, $10,000 a month apartments. I can't even keep track of what the prices are now.
Yeah. You know? No, that's all I was referring to. I mean, you know, even if you felt like it was fine, you know, your taxi drivers did not. So it was very much a case of good block, bad block, wasn't it? I mean, weren't some blocks particularly sketchy around there?
Exactly.
Yeah.
You lived in New York, so you know this, right?
A little bit.
There were blocks that you walked on, for sure. I mean, you could walk 7th Street between 7th Street between C and D or B and C was a fantastic award-winning block, and other blocks you would avoid. So you kind of, when I was then, there's a long story, but I lost those apartments and then I moved in, and eventually I was living with Sir on 10th Street between C and D. And so to go there, which was very far east, you know, I had a kind of circuitous route that I would take to get there. And in fact, if I was at the gallery and I worked past 11 o'clock at night, I would sleep on the floor because it wasn't safe to walk.
And which gallery was, which location are we talking about? At this point?
That was the 10th Street between A and B.
Okay. So 10th Street between A and B is where the gallery was at the time, and then you were living on 10th between B and C?
So C
just,
and D.
C and D. Okay. So same street, just like a couple blocks, couple avenues over.
Right.
And you were living with who?
Oh, no, wait. I'm sorry. He was on 8th Street between C and D.
Okay. And who was this?
Sir Rodney Sir, my partner.
Oh, okay.
And ex-husband.
Okay. And what's the story behind the Sir? Was he given the title by the Queen?
It's S-U-R.
Oh,
like
okay.
Surreal.
Right. Got it. Okay.
He was given the title by himself. when I met him before I even moved into the city, I was introduced to him by Al Hansen, and he was Sir Rodney Sir then. So I'm not sure exactly when he started using that moniker, but it predates my knowing him.
Right. And he was an artist?
Yes.
Was he one of the artists you showed?
I did show him. He was in one show, I think. But we collaborated on things together. Well, actually, no, I can't even say collaborated. Because I worked with him on the Sir Rodney Sir show. It was his thing. I think I was called production assistant or something on that. Mm. And he was also a curator, independent curator.
Mm-hmm. Well, what do you want to talk about as far as the gallery era of the 80s? I mean, why don't we talk a little bit about the art scene of that time? Is it correct that you started your gallery out of your bathroom in one of your, was it that first apartment?
Yes. It was in the fifth floor walk-up apartment, and it was an apartment that had the bathtub in the kitchen. So the show was actually in the loo; it was in the toilet, which was a very small room.
Right,
a very
right.
small gallery.
Yeah, and in retrospect, do you think that added to your reputation, to your legend, the legend of the Gracie Mansion Gallery? I mean, it was presumably like your close circle of artist community that would come to those kinds of shows, right?
It was only, first of all, I need to say that it was never really intended to be a gallery.
Mm.
I had received a tax return for something, maybe $200. And I thought, wow, here's $200. What are we going to do? I mean, we were all artists. We did things all the time. I mean, this is like one event out of many events that we did.
Right.
So this was more a performance than anything.
Mm-hmm.
So because I decided to do this gallery, I made stationery and I wrote a press release, and it was really a one night party.
Right.
We had cigarettes that were stamped with sayings, and we had matchbooks, and we had wine, and I served turtles. Very Pittsburgh like. You know what turtles are? Turtles are those chocolate covered caramel and
Right.
That was it. So it was an excuse to have a party.
Right.
And my friend Timothy Greathouse had just finished this really wonderful series of photographs. And so, you know, we said, I want to give you a show in my bathroom. It was like any conversation that you would have with anybody, you know, and that we did all the time. I did many events. With friends, not me personally, but together. I mean, we just did those things.
Mm-hmm.
But this one, what happened is that I did this faux press release. So it's had the dates of the show being a month at the bottom, but it had an opening date. And then I actually pulled these things out. Then after It had an opening reception day of May 4th, 1982, 6 to 10 p.m., and then show runs May 4th through May 30th by appointment. So, I mean,
nice.
There was no show. It was my apartment. But,
right.
You know, that's sort of how press releases looked. So
yeah.
That's what I wrote. So, anyway, of course, it was just all my friends. There were, you know, the whole, you know, big art community, and everybody was there, and we were having a great time.
Mm-hmm.
And there was one person there that I didn't know. So I walked up to them, and I said, you know, hi, I'm Gracie, blah, blah. And it was Melik Kalon, who worked with Howard Smith at the Village Voice. So Howard had received the press release and sent Melik out to see what this is all about. So it's because of that,
yeah.
Which was never really the intent, that I ended up having a gallery, because in the process, then I went in to talk to Howard. I mean, Melik obviously thought it was great enough for him to say, Howard, you should look into this further. And I went into the offices and I talked to Howard, and he wrote a huge article about it.
Wow.
And in the process of writing this article, he said, so what's your next show?
Right. You know, it's funny,
right.
as you were describing setting up that sort of phantom show, in a sense, you know, with the press release and all, I wanted to ask you what maybe turning point there was that made the gallery that it became. And it sounds like you answered that question. But was there, in addition to getting the write-up, was there maybe another turning point where the work was really starting to sell, or what have you, would you say?
Well, selling was never really the intention.
Mm-hmm.
Although, of course, we had price lists.
Right, right.
You know, because, you know, why not? Even though it was, you know, it was just for our friends.
Right.
It was, we knew what galleries were supposed to have, so we had, so we had a price list. And it's funny, when I was looking through this, I wanted to look through all the paperwork so that I would remember dates exactly
mm-hmm.
when I was talking to you.
Mm-hmm.
So I looked through and I found, when I sent out the press release, which, you know, said things like intimate, you know, one at a time viewing in an intimate setting sort of stuff. It was all very tongue in cheek.
Yeah.
And it did say that it says, with the Soho push for bigger and better works, under the concept of more is better, that this idea was to show works that would fit into a normal apartment. Because we all lived in these tiny apartments.
Mm-hmm.
So we were making small work and living in small apartments. But what I used to do, because I'm very superstitious, is there was this woman called the Esther Stanley.
Mm-hmm.
And she was the star lady. And so we had these forms that somehow she sent out. They're just Xerox with an outline of a hand and then a star over top of it and lines going in all these different directions. And it was covered with numbers. So you had to circle a certain number of these numbers and ask a question and send her $2. And then she would write back to you. So my question to her was, should I open an art gallery?
Mm-hmm.
And this was, I wish I had this, it's not really dated. But she would write back these like long, really, you know, studied, wonderful things. So she wrote this long letter back to me saying that I definitely, you know, that I should definitely do this. And, this studio must be unique and with a high degree of service offered. Follow without fail a single purpose and bring a form of art into every home, now drab and without color. Oh, my child, if only time would permit me to aid you in establishing this center, but I have much to do, to accomplish, and must travel on. Do place beauty upon the commonplace article and send this message into the world, and your efforts will be rewarded fourfold. It appears to be in miniature. What can it be? I have vision of that which could well be greeting cards or unique form of gift. Bless you, the Star Lady.
Huh.
So There's my turning point. The star lady told me I should open a gallery, and that was it.
And was that before or after the bathroom show?
Oh, that was before.
Oh, okay. I see.
No, I sent that when I sent out the press release. I sent that out, a copy of that out in the with the press release.
Right.
And it was also, a lot of us were involved with mail art at the time. So when we, you know, the envelope, which Melick now tells me, or Howard told me, was part of the reason that it stood out, is it was a colored envelope and everything was handwritten and it had rubber stamps and it had stamps that I made myself. We all made our own stamps. So it had my own stamps on it, on the letter. Mm-hmm. And so, I later found out that Howard, because he wrote the scenes column, which covered everything, books, movies, television, art, you know, plays, everything, he would get a huge pile. I mean, I experienced a gigantic pile every day on his desk. And so he would just literally like move his hands over the top of this as to divine what would be wonderful and like stick his hand in and pull something out and like read it. I mean, it was too much for him to read everything. Mm-hmm. So somehow this stood out. And that was the first part of good luck, I guess.
Right. Right.
And It was a bit of turning point, but there were lots of turning points along the way.
Yeah. Well, I'm just kind of picturing the gallery evolving. You know, you moved a couple of times, right, into different spaces. Was there one point, it sounds like it was all very gradual, but was there one point, you know, when you had a show and it kind of sold out, you know, or something like that? I mean, when did you start to call yourself either a dealer or a gallerist or what have you?
That's a great question. The third show, I did three shows in the bathroom of my apartment. Mm-hmm. And the third show was for Stephen Lack. And Stephen, in addition to being and continues to be a fantastic artist, was also an actor, and he was the star in Scanners. So this third show, I did this show scheduled the show with Stephen Lack. It made page six of the Post that said, you know, Stephen Lack, who starred in David Cronenberg's horror flick Scanners, is also a filmmaker and an artist. Tomorrow night, he takes his art to the can. We kid you not, Stephen's work is being displayed in the bathroom of art dealer Gracie Mansion. That's really the lady's name. And then it gives the address, the Gracie Mansion Gallery, Lou Division, which, you know, that was the Lou Division. So there was an enormous crowd. There were two times in my life where the police had to come and redirect traffic because there were so many people on the street. And that was the first time. But also what happened is because there was huge, enormous crowd of people. I'm in a tiny railroad apartment.
Right.
I don't know that there's all these people outside. I'm on the fifth floor. I'm not looking out the window. I'm like, you know, having fun.
Right.
But apparently the hallways were completely jammed the whole way up. People went all the way up to the roof, and the roof was jammed. And then outside of the apartment building, I was on a bus street. Mm-hmm. The police came and they had to redirect the buses. So out in the middle of this opening, this older Ukrainian guy shows up and he said, "I'm your super." I was like, "Really?" First time I've ever seen you.
Right.
And he said, "You can't do this anymore."
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And he was right. I mean, it was ridiculous.
Yeah.
It was totally ridiculous. So that was a turning point. Okay.
Yeah.
Done. That's over.
Yeah.
So what are you going to, you know, what are you going to do now? Not that I ever set out to be a gallerist to begin with. I mean, I was still doing my art and, you know, that was still going on. And I had a job, of course. So then...
Wait a second. What do you mean when you say you had a job, of course? What does that mean?
Well, I'm not independently wealthy. I had to work to make money to pay my rent.
Right. Well, that's what I was thinking about that, too. So in the early days when you and presumably your friends were all in small apartments paying some very small rents, you know, it was almost as if you could live for free, but you still obviously need to make a little bit of money. So what were you doing?
I was working at a gallery in Soho, and actually, that was an experience. So I was working there. I was the director of this gallery that sold mostly prints, and I hired Sir to work there. And so were doing that. And also when we were there, we were coming up with ideas of doing shows there. I can remember it was on the epicenter of the art world at that time was Spring and West Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
And Leo Castelli's gallery was at 420 West Broadway. We were like a door away or something. We were very, very close to that. So one of the first events that I did was with Buster Cleveland, where we rented a limousine. And the idea was to pull up in front of the Spring and West Broadway, and Sir was there, and we had, you know, cherries on a silver tray, and we had wine, and we had the opening on the street. And Buster's idea was he tracked Leo, and he knew that Leo Castelli walked by that corner every day on his way to Barolo, the Italian restaurant down the street.
Mm-hmm.
So Buster said, we're going to do this, and we're going to stop, and you're going to have all my artwork in a folder, because he did small mail art type things in collages. And he said, Leo will see it and I'll be discovered. So this was our, you know, like our idea. So one thing, there was one complication after another, because the limousine was done in a limousine, of course. So the limousine driver, after picking me up in a questionable neighborhood and then going to pick Buster up in yet another questionable neighborhood, he was like, give me the money right up front, because I'm not going to do this. Like, I'm not going to wait to get paid at the end. So that slowed things down. And in fact, when we pulled up, Leo was just walking by. We missed him.
Oh, no.
So, but we also did another event in the gallery that we were working at, because that gallery had windows on West Broadway, where he would hang the prints that he had inside.
Mm-hmm.
So to get in to hang those prints, there was a door, and there was a very narrow walkway behind those windows. So we had the idea to do a show in that walkway. So we put push pins on the wall, and we took coat hangers and clipped artwork to the coat hangers and had an opening where people had to go in with like a flashlight and walk sideways, shuffle sideways to get, it was only about 12 or 14 inches wide.
Mm.
So they just had to kind of shuffle and look
right
at the artwork.
Right. So this was it a guy that you were working for whose gallery this was?
Yes.
He was giving you a lot of power and autonomy, it sounds like.
I'm not even sure he knew I did that.
Oh, so you were doing this illicitly. That's why you don't want to mention what gallery it was or what?
It was a one night or day event.
Oh, okay.
But in fact, I did go to him and we did have flat files, and I did have some of the artist's works in the flat files, and I did sell them out of the flat files for his benefit.
Mm-hmm,
you know,
mm-hmm.
as he made money on those. So there was a room in the gallery that was kind of open, but there was an old couch in there, and there were just boxes of prints that were laid in there, and it was really not used in any kind of functional way, and it was open to the rest of the gallery. You could see it, and it was like a dumping spot, really kind of an eyesore. So I went to him, and I said, you know, this room that we have here, you're not using it at all, and I would like to open a gallery in that space and show the work of all my friends, and you know, we can work out compensation for whatever happens. And he said, okay, let me think about it. So I didn't, you know, he didn't get back to me for a couple weeks, and then he got back to me and he said, you know, this room that we don't use at all. I'm like, yeah. He said, I want to open up the Whorehouse Art Gallery in there. I'm going to paint it red, and I'm going to put up beaded curtains, and we're going to put up artwork done by prostitutes.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah. So
he hijacked your idea to a certain extent.
Yeah. Yes. And it was horrific, as you can imagine.
Right,
you
right.
know, framed underwear, and, you know, I didn't want to go into too many details.
Sure.
Some of it was good. There were some of the women who were talented,
mm-hmm.
and they did interesting things, and some of the others were not. But I did get to meet, it was interesting, because I got to meet a lot of the women who were really interesting people.
Mm-hmm.
Great and interesting people. But it got coverage in Playboy and in Penthouse. And this gallery was open until 10 o'clock at night, and he was not there. I mean, he would go home at 4 5, you know. Mm-hmm. So I was always there alone, and Soho at that time was dead. We're talking the 70s. There was nothing going on there after, you know, 4 or 5 o'clock. Mm-hmm. But he wanted the gallery to be open late. So it was really creepy because these guys would come in having read about this show in Penthouse or Playboy. And, you know, I had to, like, entertain these men who were coming in to see the Whorehouse Art Show.
So you were, you were the gallery sitter until 10 at night?
Yes, alone.
Right. That is creepy.
Right.
Yeah.
It was creepy. And then they would want to try, they would ask me if I could find them women, you know.
Wow.
Well.
So you were...
come to think of it, they never propositioned me.
Yeah, that must have hurt, huh? In a weird way.
Yeah.
Well, what I was thinking, you know, aside from this hard to comment on, you know, show that your boss was running, that you were a dealer before you were a dealer through this job, it sounds like.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that is essentially how I ended up being a dealer, because before working, everything that I had done in my past, or many of the things I did in my past, kind of played into it. One is that I ran this gallery. The other thing is that I worked as a typesetter and a graphic designer. Mm. So I had that background. Mm-hmm. And then the third thing was I had worked for 8 years as a legal secretary in a law commune that started around the Chicago 7 trial. So I had these secretarial skills.
Mm-hmm.
So you put those things together, and like of all of our friends, we were all artists, but when we were going to do events, who did they pick to run them or write the press release or do the graphics for the card? You know, it was me. So that's kind of how it happened.
You had to carry the weight for all your friends.
Yes.
Right. So you mentioned the over-the-top opening that you didn't even know was blocking traffic. A couple of questions about that. One, I want to ask you about what the second time was that, you know, where you blocked traffic on the street. But before that, I was wondering, you know, because it was more of a celebrity or, you know, what have, yeah, I guess celebrity, you know, social scene, gossip scene type of event or type of crowd. If you distinguish that type of crowd, an event from more of a quote unquote art world type crowd.
It was very different because it was, I don't know that there, I mean, I don't remember seeing any celebrities there. I do know that people would continue to tell me, oh, I was at the, you know, I went to your gallery when it was in your bathroom, and I don't remember them being there, but they were there. I don't question them being there. I mean, it's not like who would be a big celebrity at that time. It's not like Madonna showed up.
Right. But it was the crowd was generated by the Page Six mention, wasn't it?
The crowd was generated by the Page Six thing. Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
So then I had to stop. It was over. Okay, no more. Can't do this. This is dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was walking down St. Mark's Place. About 3 months later or something, and there was a new club that was opening up, a new bar, and my friends who were bartenders, they made a lot of money, and they only had to work like a couple days a week in order to cover their expenses.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought, I should be doing this. So I stopped in, I talked to the owner, who was Paul McGregor, who was famous in his own way. That what used to be a hair salon was the building where he was opening this bar, and supposedly the movie Shampoo was really about him, because he was a very, you know, a really this hairstylist to the stars, but he owned this building on St. Mark's. So I went in and I applied for a job to be not a bartender, because I didn't know how to do that, but to be a cocktail waitress.
Mm-hmm.
And so he hired me to do that for the opening of the club. And in the process of getting to know him, I told him that I had had this gallery and what had happened. And he said, well, I have this whole upstairs that's, you know, it's just like a dump for all the, you know, all my stuff that I've stored there for years. He said, if you clean that out, you could have a gallery there.
Mm-hmm.
And for free.
Wow.
And I was like, wow, that's fantastic. So all of us got together and, you know, organized and cleaned up the space. And there were, of course, mirrors on the walls and shelves because it had been his beauty salon.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to take those down and we turned it into a, you know, white space. Although the floor was this like fantastic colored tile, kind of funky tile floor,
right.
But it was all different colors.
Mm.
And in the back, there was still two hair washing sinks, which we couldn't remove. But it was a big space with two hair washing sinks in the back. So what, you know,
right.
Kind of great.
Right.
So I had this opportunity. So I did a show there called Beyond the American Standard. The American Standard makes toilets.
Mm.
So
mm-hmm.
it was, and it was called the Lou Division, L-I-E-U.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of L-O-O.
Mm-hmm.
So I did that show there, and it brought a huge amount of people. So Paul loved that because the people that couldn't get into the opening were going down and drinking at his bar.
Right.
So he said, wow, this is great. Why don't you do another? I'll give it to you for another month. You can do another show.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that was a big turning point because that show was called The Famous Show. And the idea was loosely based on Warhol, you know, in the future, everybody will be famous for 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of like, this is the future. This is our 15 minutes. And it was portraits of famous and soon to be famous people. And there was no time to really curate the show because it was, you know, sort of towards the end of the other show that he said, oh, you can have it for another month. So
mm-hmm.
I think this is reflective of how things were so different then. First of all, everything was artist driven, which is not true now.
Yeah.
But, you know, so the word went out, here's a theme for the show. I told everybody to just bring the work into the gallery. This other show was still up. And, you know, all, you know, they would bring for days and days and days, they would bring in the work and I would just say, okay, lean it up against the wall. And I would walk around and say, what's that? Okay, that's good. We can put that in. This doesn't work. Oh yeah, that's good. You know, and I put together this like very large show with, I mean, I'm looking, there must've been 50 artists in the show or something. It was more, it was gigantic
mm-hmm.
show. Everybody from Peter Hujar, you know, the first time I showed Peter Hujar's work. But anyway, big, big, big show. And that, again, and that was on St. Mark's Place, which you remember is kind of a very big street.
Mm-hmm.
And also a bus street. The same bus that went up 9th Street went down 8th Street. So, again, there was a situation with that opening where there was a policeman.
Right.
And the buses were rerouted, and there was this huge crowd. And I actually hired a bouncer,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
which was funny. He was just a friend of mine, but he was a bouncer for some big club. So I said, oh, can you be the bouncer for the thing? So he didn't know one person for another. So apparently he wouldn't let Julian Schnabel into the opening.
Nice. That's maybe the best part of the story. So what was he looking for then? What were his prerequisites for people getting in?
Who knows?
Yeah.
I never asked. I didn't give him any, you know, I didn't tell him what to do. I just thought that conceptually it would be funny to have have a gallery with a bouncer.
Right.
You know.
Well, what would you attribute in retrospect the immense turnout to?
I think that there were, it was a very vibrant art community at that time. Everything was possible. Everybody, it was a very big club scene. This is, it, you know, very big social. There was just a huge, broad and supportive community of artists who
right.
went out every night and did something. And this
right.
just, you know, whatever. I mean, certainly if you put 50 artists into a show, you're
yeah.
going to have a lot of people show
sure.
up for the opening.
Sure, sure. Right,
that's,
right.
That's a given. So
yeah.
there was that. And I can remember David Vonarovich was like one of the last people to come in with something, and there was no room, and so we had to hang it on the ceiling. So it's kind of funny because I have these great photographs of the opening where you can't see any of the artwork because it's just mob, but you can see David's piece because it's hanging on the ceiling.
Right. That's funny. Do you feel like looking back on it now, you know, and what you can remember of the show itself, that it was a good show? I mean, or was it not even necessarily about being a good show so much as about being an event?
I think, was it a good show? I mean, I don't think it's a show that's going to go down in history. I mean, I think there was good art in the show. Not all of the art was good, but there was a pretty nice percentage of very good art in the show. It wasn't conceptually an interesting, very interesting theme. I mean, portraits of famous people is, you know, so loose as to be not really compelling historically. But I think that what it did is that it showed what the times were all about. I mean, this show, Marcia Tucker brought her board. Marcia Tucker was the director of the new museum, and she brought all her board members to see this show. And for them, this was something, I mean, I forged relationships that day with people that are still like my best friends. I mean, she was wonderful about that, but this was something brand new, and this was something that was like interesting and exciting and extremely free-spirited.
Yeah, and the two names you've mentioned, David Vonarovich and Peter Hujar, are huge, you know, and have become huge, certainly, even if they weren't at the time. But, I mean, would you say they were among the most interesting artists of that scene? Or maybe a better question is, were they sort of quintessential East Village artists of that era?
Well, first of all, Peter Hujar was a god. All of us.
Okay.
He was a few years older. I was interestingly, I was 10 years older than everybody else at that time. It was because I had had this whole life prior to moving to New York, and I was a late bloomer. So when I did open up my real gallery, which is on 10th Street, which is like a real turning point, I was 10 years older than all the people who simultaneously opened galleries that I didn't even know, but we all opened galleries at the same time within months of each other.
Right.
And they were in their 20s and I was in my 30s. But Peter was yet another generation, but everybody knew who he was. And David was also somebody that everyone, you know, looked up to. But my favorite piece in the show, if you want to know, was this this artist came in, Snooky Tate, and he had a twig, and he threw this twig on the floor. And I'm like, well, that's interesting, Snooky, but what's that? But, you know, I said, this is a show, I was like very, you know, this is a show about portraits of famous people, you know, And he said, And I said, well, this has to be, you know, famous. This has to be a portrait of a famous person. He said, it is. I said, well, who is it? He said, Step and Fetch It. Brilliant. I mean, how brilliant is that? So that was in the middle of the show, in the middle of the floor with like tape around it so people didn't step on it.
I'm glad you mentioned the 10th Street Gallery. And it sounds like since you did use the turning point phrase, that was another turning point. That was maybe your first quote unquote gallery, as it were. But I also I'm curious too, because I did want to ask you about the other galleries, and I know there was International with Monument, and I believe there was another one right next door virtually to it as well. But so those are the galleries that you're talking about that were, as opposed to the early 80s, the later 80s, right? That all those that you and all those were opening. Is that right?
That was later. They were SVA students. It was later, because our earlier galleries were the Fun Gallery and Civilian Warfare, 51X, myself, and Nature Mort.
That was the other one I was thinking of. I thought Nature Mort was part of the International with Monument era, but no, it was earlier.
No, International with Monument is later. And as a matter of fact, it's an interesting story about that, because I showed Marilyn Minter. And when International with Monument opened, it wasn't too late in the 80s, because by like 88, everybody had left the East Village.
Yeah, so it was like 87, probably.
Yeah, or even 85.
Wow.
Could have been 85. Because things were going so fast. I mean, I had those things in my bathroom I'm just looking at the famous show. That was 82. And then the gallery on 10th Street, which was really the turning point because that was a brick and mortar gallery that I had a lease on. So that was, and there's an interesting story about that, which I would really like to tell.
Sure.
So that was 83. So International with Monument was after that. It could have been 84, 85, but things were going so fast.
Mm-hmm.
So that the difference between 82, when like Fun Gallery opened, Bill Stelling opened it in his apartment. I did the bathroom shows and the things on St. Mark's Place. And 83, when those like Nature Mort and all those other people and Civilian Warfare, we were all opening 82, 83. So when you go to 84, 85, it seems like centuries later because things were happening so fast. So the first galleries were all opened by artists. The second wave of galleries were opened by people who had worked at galleries and weren't artists, but they had worked for a gallery and then they came, like PPOW. Mm-hmm. They came to the East Village and thought, we can do this too. We're going to have our own gallery.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So there was a difference. But when International with Monument opened, which I don't know the year, but I had the gallery and had a lot of notoriety. And, you know, we were selling things and the artists were, you know, successful and everything was really great. The International with Monument opened and Marilyn Minter came to me and she said, it's over.
Wow.
What did she mean? You're not going to want to believe it, but it's over.
Uh-huh.
And she was right.
What did she mean?
I mean, that what we were doing, which was fun and free and also political.
Right.
A lot of the work that I showed, you know, was political. And other work was, like Rodney Greenblatt's work was very fun and colorful and, you know, lively and you know, Ron Zwillinger was doing work about women's work and there was like politics in it and David von Rovich was political and all of that. But International with Monument was very conceptual. I mean, it was completely different. It was the beginning of Neo Geo. Mm-hmm. And it was a totally different, it was just 360 degrees from what everybody else was doing.
Mm-hmm.
Or what I was doing, certainly. I can only talk for myself. So when she said, it's over, in a way, it was. I mean, everything started going in that direction.
What do you think led her to make that proclamation, though? There's an implication that she thought this work was not only the new thing, it was better. And did she imply that she wanted to be a part of that as well?
No, she didn't imply that, but what she saw there, she really liked, and she recognized immediately that it was something that was different and interesting. And, I mean, how could you not, like, go into Jeff Koons's, I think it was his first show, where he had a aqua lung and a lifeboat, life-size lifeboat out of bronze.
Right.
I mean, it was brilliant.
Right. Yes, I am aware of that show. Yeah, and I'm just trying to put into words what that transition was, and it sounds like from what you're saying that it was kind of the end of a carefree era and a movement into a serious era, something to that effect. Is that fair?
Well, Elaine Dannheiser said, "Let me think exactly what she said." I don't want work that makes me feel. I want work that makes me think.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think that was pretty apt for the change that happened.
So how did that ultimately, at that time, start to affect your business, your role as a gallerist?
Well, I mean, I had a very strong following, and the artists were really great, and there was still a lot of support, and there were museum shows, and all of that was going on, but we weren't part of the International with Monument, Pat Hearn, Colin DeLand, which was called Vox Populi at the time. And even, you know, like Nature Mort was more leaning into the more conceptual end of it.
Mm-hmm.
But things went on. I mean, absolutely things went on. But the artists that showed with International with Monument within, very short amount of time were showing with Ileana Sonnabend and Leo Castelli.
Right.
Mm-hmm. They took all of them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting. But there's something, there's sort of, it feels like there's a subtext here, even if you went, things went on and you went on and so on, that I want to sort of, and I don't know if I'm projecting too much, but it feels like there, this was the kind of the beginning of the end of the East Village. Maybe it, there was a correlation with the real estate market to some extent.
Well, the real estate market did change, and it, there was also... there was also the situation that we were all, the first galleries were all in small storefronts, 500 square feet, mm-hmm. maybe less, 350 square feet, tiny little galleries. And there weren't, I mean, there weren't big spaces in the East Village. I mean, I moved the gallery to Avenue A into a space that was much bigger. I turned my gallery into the Gracie Mansion Museum store, and I took over this bigger space that had been a plumbing supply place on Avenue A. I mean, Pat Hearn moved to huge place on between C and D on, I'm thinking, 9th Street.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a really big industrial place. And PPOW moved to 8th Street between B and C in the old 8BC building. So one, you know, you have a lot of success when you want to expand and you need a bigger space because the, your artists are demanding it. It happened very fast. There were only, a few places that could accommodate this, and Fun Gallery had moved since moved into a space that was, you know, somewhat, that was bigger. And then all of a sudden everybody moved to Broadway. They moved to Soho, and they moved to the second floor, the upstairs spaces on Broadway, because it was cheaper. Because now, you know, there's notoriety. All the landlords see what's happening. We initially took over spaces that were drug dens, and they were really happy to have us pay $500 and do a legitimate business out of there.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, when the leases became due, you know, they wanted lots more, and they, and more and more and more, and it became cheaper to move, to get a huge space on Broadway. So that's where many of the galleries moved.
Was that ever in the cards for you, on the table for you, or what was your landscape?
I did too.
You did too?
I did also, yeah.
Which space are we talking about?
It was on Broadway between Spring and Prince, and it was in, I had a whole floor in a building. It was PPOW had a floor, and John Good had a floor, and I had a floor.
And how were things there?
The timing was terrible. I moved there in 1989, and the market crashed in 1990.
Right. Ouch.
And I closed... Ouch, and I closed. And if you want to, you know, if you want to just like follow me and do like pick to do things at all the wrong time, buy your house at the height of the market, did it, you know, like move into a like gigantic 5,000 square foot gallery, like, and then the market crashes.
Yeah.
And then when I moved to Chelsea, I moved my gallery to Chelsea in June of 2001, like right before 9/11.
Wow.
So. It's like, you know, just
but there was
follow
a
me around.
Right, but there was a recovery of, you know, I don't know what the time frame was, but there was a recovery that was much faster than there would be after the recession of 2008-09 after 2001. So, I mean, but did you not stay around that long?
I didn't.
Yeah.
But from the, I closed the gallery in Soho, and I guess it was 1992, and then I moved into this brownstone on St. Mark's Place. There was some time in between, and I started doing gallery out of there, and then I moved to Chelsea in right before 9/11, and I was only there for a year. I've never had deep pockets, you know,
right,
so
right.
It was I couldn't get through these hard times.
Yeah.
I just wasn't prepared. And speaking, this is the story that I wanted to tell you, if I can like go back as to like this turning
sure.
point of when I got a brick and mortar space,
sure.
is that when I had the gallery on St. Mark's Place that I had, you know, for that short time, I did a third show there, which was a show for Carmen Cicero, who was an artist of yet another generation, much older, and he was my teacher at Montclair.
Mm-hmm.
And did a great show for Carmen there. But when I did that show, at that point, Paul says, okay, you have to pay now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I can't remember what he wanted me to pay, $1,000 or something. So I did that one show, but I couldn't afford to do any more. So, but this couple came into the gallery and they said, you know, we have missed big opportunities before. We see what you're doing and we know that you're going to be really famous and we want to invest. You know, we want to be in your investors.
Wow.
So go out, find a space. And once you've found a space, come back to us. Here's our card. Come back to us and we will back you.
Wow.
And I was like, whoa. So talk about turning point. Well,
yeah.
Major turning point,
yeah.
right? It's like, so I, you know, went around and I looked and I looked. Sarah and I looked and we found this place on 10th Street between A and B across from the park. It was perfect. It was $500 a month. And so I called them up. I said, okay, I found the place. Let's talk. And so we set up a meeting and I had, there was a collector, Danielle Sauté. Danielle and Jim Sauté were wonderful collectors that I had met through Jim Stark, who I had also met, who was a lawyer and a great friend. So I invited Jim Stark to come on this meeting as a lawyer, and Danielle was like a finance person. She was a bookkeeper for working with Jim at the time. And so we met in a restaurant. So the people said, great, you know, we're all ready. We, you know, let's see this lease. That all looks great. And here's the deal. You know, we will give you $25,000 in exchange for which we want 100% of your profits for the gallery. And you can buy back 50% of your profits by paying us back the $25,000 or something like that. It wasn't even 25, it was like 10,000. It was like ridiculous. The whole thing was like totally ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we were just like aghast. So I said, well, you know, thanks a lot, but this is, you know, I have credit cards. I can charge that kind of money. You know, it's certainly, this is not at all plausible. But here I had found a gallery space. So Jim Stark said, listen, he said, I think what you're doing is crazy. You don't open up a gallery where artists live. You open up a gallery where collectors live. But if you, you know, I can see you're passionate about this. You want to do this. And I will promise to buy enough artwork to pay the rent for a year.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, whoa, okay. You know, a little bit naive on my part. But it was like, and he gave me a couple thousand dollars up front so that I could get Con Ed to turn on the thing and give like first and last month's rent or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what he was basically saying with $500 for rent, he was basically saying that he would spend $1,000 a month on art.
Mm-hmm.
That was his commitment. And in fact, he never had to do it. I mean, it was never, the gallery was a success right away.
Wow.
I mean, not that he didn't continue to buy artwork. I mean, he did. He was, you know, he bought artwork, but it was not necessary for him to really do it past the first month.
Mm-hmm. When you said earlier that you didn't have deep pockets, once you were working in the brick and mortar spaces, what kind of sales would you say you were having? I mean, would you say there's a particular average that you would have in a given month, or was it like, did it vary widely depending on the year and the month, or how would you categorize that?
It's very funny you should ask that, because I never knew how to price anything. And I thought, you know, I was very naive. I was an artist. I thought there has to be, how do I put a price on something? There must be some concept, like first artist, first show, a work this size, blah, 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 should sell for this. So mm-hmm. I set up a meeting mm-hmm. with Leo Castelli to have him answer these questions for me. So I went to see Leo and I asked those questions. So Leo, how do I price something? I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know how to put a price on something. He said, the price is whatever somebody will pay.
And that was the end of the meeting.
That was the end of the meeting. Thank you. He was such a sweet man. But
right.
That's how naive we were. We
right.
all were.
Right.
I mean, we didn't know. And it was all, you know, at the time, I was dating Nick Scheide, and Nick was the front desk person for Sonnabend for 30 years or 25 years or something. So it was interesting because these collectors would come in and, you know, they would say, you know, I'm interested in buying this, and I'm like the Rubels. I want to buy everything and I'll pay over time. And then, you know, I would call up Nick, who are these people? And it was all the same people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he knew who everyone was.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't like we got a new collector base coming out of the East Village. No, it was the same people who were buying in Soho.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's just that we were open on Sundays. So it was like, you know, they gave them someplace to go. And that's also interesting, you know, that it's when I opened up, more interesting to me, maybe it'd be interesting to the people who are listening to this, I don't know, but when I opened my gallery, I had a job, so that had to pay for the expenses of running this gallery and my rent and all this kind of stuff,
mm-hmm.
and so I couldn't be open Tuesday through Saturday, which is when galleries were open,
mm-hmm.
so I had my gallery open Wednesday through Sunday, and it stuck. I mean, years later, when the galleries started opening, even in the Lower East Side, you know, like, 20, 30 years later, they stayed with the format, many of them, of Wednesday through Sunday.
Mm.
So it was kind of a weird thing that stuck all those years.
It's too bad you couldn't have patented that, huh?
Yeah.
So, but going back to my question, I mean, the sense I'm getting is that first of all, you had to have a job to sort of be consistently supporting your gallery rent, right? But I mean, were there months, were there even years where you were earning a lot because you were selling well? And if so, did you then have a surplus? And you know what I mean? Or was it always kind of a little bit hand to mouth?
No, I mean, it changed. I stopped working, you know, of course, because the gallery, you know, the gallery supported Sir and supported me and supported Sir. But we were pretty frugal. I took $800 a month as a salary, and Sir took $500 because my rent in my apartment was more than Sir's. So it kind of worked out that's that I got a little bit more than him. But when we, you know, we had really successful shows, which we did. I mean, we did art fairs.
Mm.
We, you know, we did a catalog for Hope Sandro. We did full page ads and Art Forum.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we did. The money was spent the money was spent. It didn't like, you know.
You invested it back
there,
into the gallery.
We spent it.
You invested it back in the gallery to some extent.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Right.
I mean, we bought artwork.
Mm-hmm.
You know, then when things got tough or we had slim months, then we would have to sell that artwork. But
right, right.
Yeah.
Well, one thing I want to go back to, just your description of being in the wrong time for all of these moves that you made and so on. I know you say that a little bit tongue in cheek, but I do want to point out that you were in the East Village when you could pay $100 rent. So imagine if you were an artist moving into Bushwick, you know, in the 2010s, and compare those two, and then tell me that you had bad timing.
You're right. I mean, that was a golden age for sure to be able to do that.
Yeah.
But it was also, I think people, now, because I was not in the business and was just like an artist and had a job, I didn't know that. But people told me that was also a recession period, 1982.
Hmm.
But I have no idea if that's true or not.
Huh. Okay.
I mean, things are all cyclical. It could totally
sure.
be possible.
Sure. Right. So let's clarify like your chronology as far as having the Gracie Mansion Gallery. So you had the gallery in Chelsea for a year in Chelsea. And then what happened? The funds ran out, or?
Yeah, the funds ran out. Mm-hmm. And because believe me, after 9/11, it was tumbleweed going down the streets.
Mm-hmm.
People were not buying art. People even that were not, you know, it was like, you can't write lyric poetry after the Holocaust. I mean, it mm-hmm. was, you're going to call somebody up and ask them to come down and see a show when thousands of people had just been brutally murdered.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was, you just put your head down and, you know, went on. But nobody was buying art.
Right, right.
It was just not done. I mean, maybe they were buying it surreptitiously, but they certainly weren't walking around at galleries and, you
mm-hmm,
know,
mm-hmm.
doing any of that.
It sounds like then was your experience that it was worse being a gallery at that time, even compared to whenever the recession of 2008, 2009 started to hit the art market?
Well, I didn't have a gallery in 2008 and 2009, so I really can't.
Right.
I was a private dealer.
Right.
And so I can't really speak to what it was like at that time. But I could say it's like when 9/11, it was like the door is open, the door is closed.
Sure.
That was it. It was like, you know. And interestingly, I had an opening that was scheduled for that night with Amanda Lear. And that Jimmy Dams had curated. Jimmy is friends with Amanda.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were doing this show for Amanda Lear on 9/11, opening on 9/11. And she said, well, we still have to have the opening. The opening is scheduled. We have to have it. The press is going to come.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, I really, you know, we've just had this huge tragedy. I really don't think the press is going to come, but... I did it. I walked over. There was no, you know, no transportation of any sort. I had to walk from my apartment in the East Village over to Chelsea. And you know what? The press did come.
Hmm.
And some people came.
Mm-hmm. What was the mood like?
Bizarre.
Yeah. I can imagine.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so what about then, talk about you're transitioning into becoming a private dealer. So does that essentially mean that you represent mainly the same artists just out of your apartment and you have private meetings? So instead of being an LLC or whatever as a gallery, that you're just, do you have the same sort of license as a private dealer? And do you have people over to your house to see the work? How does that work?
You do have people over to your house to see the work, but it's no longer, I'm not only working with the artists that had been part of my stable. It's a completely different thing. I mean, private dealing is, I was able to work with artists that I didn't represent, but artists whose work I was really passionate about. And also, you know, you're working with a lot of blue chip artists. I mean, private dealing is mainly with blue chip.
So we're talking about secondary market, kind of.
Secondary market, exactly.
Yes, right. And give me a little snapshot or, you know, a synopsis of what that is like. Is it satisfying?
Yeah, it is, actually, because it can be very satisfying. It can mm-hmm. be very exciting
mm-hmm.
because... You know, just like what I loved about the gallery is that you never knew what it was going to be like from one day to the next because you didn't know who was going to walk in the door or what was going to transpire. With private dealing, it's a little difficult. It's a little different in that you have to create yourself every single day. You know, nothing is walking in your door. Like, everything that happens is something that you've made happen. So that's a part that's like extraordinarily different. And it's not that I had intended to be a private dealer, but once the gallery closed, it was like, what am I going to do? I mean, I have to, life goes on, and it seemed like that was, it just started happening. Actually, it almost instantly started happening that people were asking me for things. And because I had been in the business for a long time, I knew where you know, if a collector would ask me for a herring, I knew who owned herrings.
Mm-hmm.
So I was very successful as a private dealer because, unlike most private dealers, I, for the most part, had both ends of the deal. I had the buyer and I had the seller.
So to what extent then, I mean, I'm hearing two different things. I'm hearing on one hand that it was like you have to go out and make things happen, you know, that you don't just have a gallery and wait for people to come. But then on the other hand, I'm hearing like you already had all these connections in place. So was it a little bit of both? You know, on one hand, you had all these connections in place, but on the other hand, you did have to wake up and sort of make things happen as well.
Well, I mean, these connections were in place, but they didn't. But I had to call and talk to people. What, you know, what? How's it going? What are you looking for? Are there any artists that you know can I help you find, or somebody, you know, or saying, do you want to? Are you selling something? Is there some? You know, it's you have to go out and find the buyers and find the sellers. It's they don't. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's much more proactive. It's
right.
A different. Thing. I mean, with, yeah.
It sounds challenging to make those calls.
It was kind of challenging, and it was also, it was a very interesting, for me, psychologically very interesting transition, because when I had the gallery, I was calling people to come in and see a show. I was always felt very uncomfortable about it because it was so much about me, because the gallery was me,
mm-hmm.
and the artists were my employees almost. I mean, mm-hmm. They depended on me to support themselves and their families.
Mm.
And so when I was calling people and wanting them to come in, it was like almost, I almost felt like I was asking personally for this. Whereas when I became a private dealer, all of that was gone. And also I came out of a very left-wing background. I mean, making money was bad. You know, anybody who had money was like a bad person.
Right.
Eat the rich.
Right.
You know, it was like you were never supposed to make money. So I battled against that for like my whole life. And it was only when I started, when I had closed the gallery and some years after that in private dealing that I was like, became comfortable with making money.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, okay to make money.
Was there a turning point there where, you know, that you can look back on and say, oh yeah, I kind of feel like my attitude or my perception changed at that point?
Well, I think that, I mean, it changed immediately when I started private dealing that I didn't feel guilty selling something, to asking somebody to buy something or showing something to someone. With the idea that they might be interested in purchasing it. So that was instantly different. And then it was also different. The first piece that I sold as a private dealer, it was like, this money is mine?
Mm-hmm.
Because the money had never been mine for all those years. The money was the gallery's.
Mm. Right.
You know? So it was like, whoa, this is great. You mean this is all mine and I get to keep this?
Right.
And I made a lot of money as a private dealer.
Right. But then, so that even further raises the question, then how did you reconcile your past values with becoming such a capitalist so quickly?
It didn't happen right away. It took a number of years.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then eventually I became comfortable with it, and I felt like it was good, and I deserved to make money.
Right. So it's just a question of getting used to it, in other words.
Yes, I guess. I mean, when I had the gallery, I initially opened the gallery. I thought that I was doing, it came out of us doing something for the artists that were friends of mine, mm-hmm. doing something, providing something for the community, mm-hmm. providing a space for the artists who were friends, doing this all together, a communal effort. We all work together. We're all, you know. That was how it started.
Yeah. I just wonder, when we go back to the East Village, sort of when you were earlier in the brick and mortar, or in the middle of the brick and mortar phase, and you described your colleagues who were moving into, or your contemporaries who were moving into these really big spaces. You know, you mentioned a couple of them if the difference came down to them being more capitalist, more calculated, you know, in their operation than you, because you did see it as more of a socialist type of approach.
It could have been. Mm-hmm. I didn't think of it that way at the time.
Right.
I mean, it could have been. I remember somebody saying to me, you know, that my big mistake was, like, why Pat Hearn was more successful than me is that she sold paintings that looked good in houses with 50s furniture.
Right. Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah, you have to have a certain, I mean, in every version of, in any of those scenarios, you have to have a certain amount of blinders, it seems like. You know, you're either having blinders to only selling stuff that's going to work well behind a couch, or you're going to have blinders to the capitalist opportunities that you're maybe putting on to the side so that you can support your friends and your community.
That's true.
So from being from the private dealer era that we were just talking about to what you're doing now, you know, which I know we won't talk about in full detail, but can you talk about getting this job and how what you're doing now with ArtNet is different from being a private dealer?
Sure. I mean, when... again, like going to work at ArtNet was, again, the mother of invention. You know, as I had mentioned, I was very successful as a private dealer. I had just bought my house in the Hamptons in July of 2008. In October of 2008, the market crashed. Everything ended, like, completely for me at that point. Mm. Private dealing, like, all the people. I had started, like, really focusing on a few people that I was building collections for. And instead of having like a broad base of people that I was working for, I was really concentrating on a few people because they were demanding and it was successful and we were working on collections together. They all stopped simultaneously at that. And so all of a sudden I had a house. I had never mm-hmm. had a house before. I had never had a mortgage. Mm-hmm. So I had a mortgage. And also when I bought the house, I had two roommates, one who had been a roommate out there for 8 years and one that had been a roommate for 12 years. So it was all part of my calculation as to, you know, their rent and what they could pay and how this was going to figure into, you know, the mortgage. And by January of 2009, both of them had left. One left in September and one left in January. So here I was, I had no income, and I had a mortgage. So I called up Deb Ripley, who worked at ArtNet. And I said to Deb, listen, will you take a room in the house? Because Deb had been a roommate of mine for mm-hmm. years mm-hmm. previously, as had many people in the art world. It was always, you know, all artists and friends who had shared the house over the years. And so Deb said, sure, no problem, I'll do that. She said, but why don't you come down and speak to Bill Fine? She said, Bill Fine likes you. She said, you could do, like, work one day a week, and it would just be enough to, like, take the burn off or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, I can't remember exactly how she put it. Mm-hmm. So I said, okay, well, I'll do that. She, you know, agreed to take a room, and then I set up this appointment with Bill Fine, and Bill was like, great, come to work. You can come to work full time. And I'm like, I'm not really want to come to work full time. And so we came to an agreement, you know, that I would be, you know, would be an independent contractor, and I would work at, you know, in the auction department, the online auction department, which was just, this was 2009, it had just started in 2008, so it was really in the beginning, you know, in mm-hmm. the very beginning. Mm-hmm. And that was a, you know, that was a lifesaver for me. It was great. And I like really loved it instantly. It was funny because it was something completely different than what I had done. I mean, I never for a million years thought that I would be able to sell or could we even consider selling artwork that people didn't see.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was all done online. But what it had, which was closer, which was a little bit, it was a little bit like private dealing because mm-hmm. I had to, you know, bring artwork in to be sold, mm-hmm. you know, but instead it was sold in an auction format, but also find people to buy things. So it was, I was using those talents that I had as a private dealer. For sourcing material and selling material, but also there were things that, you know, that people just, that I was meeting that came to ArtNet and bought things that I would never have been able to find myself. So I felt that I was much better able to serve my clients that I had for a long time, the collectors and friends that I had worked with over time, because I had such a broader base of people to sell things to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's as a private dealer, I was only selling to, you know, the coterie of people that I worked with and that I knew. But all of a sudden, I could say to them, listen, you know, we have like 100,000 people or however many that are, you know, coming online looking at artwork.
Mm-hmm.
So it worked out good for everyone. It worked out good for my clients, and it worked out good for me. And now I'm full time, and it sort of segued into being full time, not instantly, but there's just so much work that you could, you know, it's like not a 40-hour week job, you know. Even so, it was really hard to do, if not impossible, to do it in 3 days because it is international and it is 24/7. I mean, mm-hmm. if something is up online, you get calls and you get emails and you have to respond. You have to be ready to respond 24/7. So it's not it worked into being a full-time job.
So you're dealing mostly with JPEGs, but it sounds like you are going to clients and photographing work, so then you're turning clients' work into JPEGs that is then going to be consumed or potentially bought through JPEGs.
Yes, and it's not unlike if I had a gallery, because people, as you've probably heard, don't walk into galleries anymore,
right.
Or a lot less.
Right.
And and these galleries are selling things through their websites, and they're selling things through JPEGs that they send to clients by email.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not much different.
Yeah.
You know, this is how the market has evolved.
Well, what kind of finer points would you make about buying, purchasing, collecting work that you have only gotten to take in through the screen?
I think that, you know, what's happening, the part of it that I find troublesome from an artist's point of view is that, and having known what it was like when I, you know, having represented artists, that artists would work for a year or two putting together a show.
Yeah.
And that show in its entirety was making a statement. I mean, it mm-hmm. was important to go to that show, see those pieces, understand what had been going on, what that artist had to say that took them 2 years to say.
Mm-hmm.
So now, you know, what I've seen happen is that people were not, I don't know why nobody has any time anymore, but people just don't have time anymore, you know, not going into galleries as much, and it has segued into going to art fairs, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that has changed a lot for artists. And for galleries. So a collector is going to be seeing one piece in a booth by that artist
mm-hmm.
and not maybe understanding fully and conceptually mm-hmm. what that one piece is about.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So things are being bought. There are exceptions to this. Of course, there's passionate collectors that find out everything about an artist before mm-hmm. they buy them. Read everything, go to see all the shows. I mean, God bless them. These are the people that we love. This is what's holding the whole, you know, everything together for mm-hmm. me. But there are other people who buy, you know, by name. They need to have one of these and one of these and one of these. Or they buy by gallery. Like who do you have in your collection? Oh, everybody that David Zwirner shows. Oh, that's interesting. Thanks. You know, it's you know, people buy in different ways. Some people, many people use advisors.
Yeah, sure. To what extent do you get to have an influence on those kinds of overly thoughtless curations?
Do you mean, are you talking about the curations of somebody's collection?
Yeah, I'm talking about somebody who only collects artists from David Zwirner or only wants to have one of each of these celebrity artists, you know. To what extent can you influence them in your role, or is that not even on the table?
Well, I mean, I think that when I do have interactions with collectors, which, you know, I do, because I have this, you know, how can I say this without like patting myself on the back? I have a
Go
long history and I have a knowledge about,
yeah.
you know, an in-depth knowledge about some artists and some periods and some whatever that I can talk to them about what the influences of something that they just bought, how it was influenced and who maybe they should look at that was somebody that influenced that artist that they just bought
mm-hmm.
or that would be, you know, or that they should consider looking at this because they have that, they should really consider, you know,
mm-hmm.
looking at this and they do.
Mm-hmm. That's good. I'm glad to hear that you're helping educate them. That's important.
in whatever small way.
Yeah. Well, that counts. That definitely counts. Are you attending auctions as sort of an auction expert, or is it only online auctions that you work with?
I don't really. Mm-hmm. I mean, I have attended some auctions, but I don't really go to all the auctions.
Right.
I'm you know, we're very busy. We have a very busy auction schedule.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm a specialist in post-war and contemporary work, in unique work, paintings and sculptures. But, you know, I participate in two or three auctions a month I have to, you know, get work for.
I see.
So that's a lot. So it doesn't leave a lot of time to hang out and go to visit everybody else's auction. What I try to do is, which I think, you know, works for me, is the best use of my time because I can't go to all the gallery shows.
Mm-hmm.
I end up doing exactly what I'm complaining about the collectors doing, is I go to art fairs because in an art fair I can see 50, 60 galleries and what they're showing, find out what's hot, what's new, what's selling, what the prices are. You know, because when I'm at my job, I'm looking at auction records.
Yeah.
And that's a completely different thing. That's not the retail market. So I really have to find out what things are selling for retail,
mm-hmm.
who's interesting, what's coming up, what artists that were obscure are now all of a sudden showing with Paula Cooper.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that sort of thing. So I do, like these collectors, get a lot of my information by going to art fairs.
Mm-hmm. And with everything that you have on your plate, to what extent do you even have an interest or desire to go see shows that are, you know, in the galleries? Particularly, and I'll just say by way of extreme example, the episode that I just put out last night today is with this couple who run this gallery called Mrs., which is in Queens.
Mm-hmm.
What are the chances that you would get to a far-flung gallery like that at this point when you have the schedule that you do?
Well, actually, last night I went to Three Star Books, which opened up a place in Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic. And it was, I love what they do. And, I made the trek out there. And then when I left there, I went to a performance at the Emily Harvey Foundation. So I do get out and do things, you know, mostly things that happen at the end of the day. So it wouldn't be unusual that I could go to an opening at a place in Queens.
Mm-hmm. I didn't start the conversation talking about the origin of your name. So maybe before we wrap things up, we should do that. It may be the kind of thing that you're a story that you're tired of telling. I don't know, but I want to hear from your own experience rather than from what I can read about how you took on the name Gracie Mansion.
Well, okay, I'm happy to do that.
Great.
And I have new insights into the name because I
Excellent.
Went to MoMA just opened a show about Club 57. So I think everybody who can should come to New York and see that show. It's totally, it really shows you what was possible and totally artist-driven moment. I mean, Club 57 was a club that was in the basement of a Polish church on St. Mark's Place, at 57 St. Mark's Place.
Mm-hmm.
And it was run by Ann Magnuson and Kenny Scharf and Keith Haring and Tina Lohatsky and Min and, you know, a bunch, and Sanchez, a bunch. It was like a group of artists. And they did a one-night events. It was the whole inspiration was for the Mud Club,
mm-hmm.
and other places that did one-night events. But it all started with Club 57.
Mm-hmm.
They had no money, but they would do, like, one night they would do wrestling. And another night they would do B-movie night.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually recreated Kenny Scharf's Dayglow room that he created, and I actually participated in that. They did, I think they painted the whole inside of the place black, and it was all black lit, and you had to do artwork with these Dayglow paints, and you know, you would go in and at like 8 o'clock and put the artwork up, and then you would come back at 2 or 3 in the morning and take it home. So they recreated the Kenny's Dayglow room, and then he later, in 1985, did it at the Whitney in the Biennial. But you see, like, the very beginnings of all this, and you see, you know, how things were thrown together. I mean, like, a beautiful little handout that said, come and visit Kenny and Keith at their apartment, you know,
mm-hmm.
come for cocktails. And it was, you know, it was a community then. I mean, an amazing community, and it's reflected in this. I mean, in the East Village, we had the East Village Orchestra. We performed like 3 times or something like that, and it was all the artists who showed in the East Village,
mm-hmm.
and dealers.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we were a community.
Right.
And all the dealers knew each other, all the artists knew each other, and all the writers knew each other, and we all hung out together. But anyways, this whole thing about my name. So I moved to the East Village, and I was meeting these people like Tina Lohatsky and John Sachs and Tommy Gunn. And Tommy Gunn was the one that really was the one that stuck out for me, and Gary Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
Because those names were something in their entirety, but the first part of their name was a first logical first name.
Right.
Does that make sense to you?
Right, yeah.
So I love that. So I was sitting around with Timothy Greathouse, who had the first show in my gallery, by the way, in the blue. And he was like my dearest friend. And so we're hanging out. And I'm like, oh, I want a name. You know, just whatever.
What was your name before?
Joanne Mayhew.
Okay.
So I was like, I think it'd be fun to have a name. I want to have a name too. Just teasing, right? Or just whatever, talking, hearing yourself talk. And so I went through, you know, I was trying to go through some names like Andrea Doria. Oh, too depressing. Don't want that. And then I pretty quickly hit on Gracie Mansion, and Timothy was like, yes, that's perfect. He said, that is so you. That's totally perfect. And then he just started calling me Gracie. And it just, I don't know, it just sort of hit. And I started using that name. I mean,
wow.
Up to now, I've changed my name legally.
Right.
But what was funny is that when I was looking, you know, this whole show at Club 57, and there were all these photographs of these transvestites.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, they all had fantastic names.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, my name, because there was one I came across, Terry Cloth. How fabulous is that? And then I started thinking, oh my God, it's like I have a transy name, Gracie Mansion.
Right. I feel like I need to change my name. Do you have any in the name store that you might recommend?
Let me think about this.
Okay.
So we want to incorporate your real name in some way?
I don't know. I mean, it may be hard not to at this phase, but not necessarily. You know, I'm open to completely new names like you did.
How about Rickshaw?
Rickshaw. I don't know. That's a I'm not sure that's the best association.
I'll think about it.
Okay. All right. We'll continue this conversation offline. Well, Gracie, okay. It's been great talking to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Absolutely. And we're out. Thank you to Gracie for coming on the show. Good night, Gracie. As George Burns liked to say, wanted to remind you that the website for this podcast is theconversationpod.com. And just to fill you in finally on that t-shirt, the front of the t-shirt has the P word on it. If you are not familiar with the whole deal with the P word, it is the P-R-A-C-T-I-C-E word, which is banned from being spoken on this show. And Patrick Kamut, a listener and art teacher at a high school in Pittsburgh, had the idea. He has been listening and he heard me either bleep that word or give somebody a hard time about it, or it was noticeably cut from the recording. And he cracked up when he heard that and was inspired to come up with an expletive-filled version of that word. So that is essentially what we have come up with, what he has come up with. So there are the front and tail ends of the P word with the middle made up of expletive symbols, you know, the ampersand, the at, the number sign, etc. So that is on the front of the t-shirt. The back has the podcast logo. It's $20 plus $6.25 shipping in the U.S., if you're out of the U.S. and you're interested, get in touch and we will work something out. But as I said at the beginning, this is probably going to be the first and last run. So do jump on this now. And if you're maybe on the fence, go for it, because you will regret not getting one later, I think. And I didn't say this last time, but if you are sort of on the fence because you're maybe not sure about the P word on the front or the logo on the back, we can certainly work something out where you just get the P word or you just get the logo. So if you are intrigued to step up for either one of those, do let us know. We can work that out as well. Also, you can support the show other than the t-shirt by my favorite way, financial contributions to the show, which you can do one of two ways. You can become a pledger on Patreon, which is linked through the site, where you can support the show for as little as $1 a month. If you start at $3 a month, you will be on the list. You will get bonus episodes. You will get my undying love. The other way that you can support the show financially is through PayPal. With a donation of $25 or more, one-time donation, you will get those same things. Thank you very much in advance. Every little bit helps. We keep the show going through your financial contributions, so thank you very much in advance. Non-financially, you can support the show by following on social media at Artist Podcast. Become a fan on Facebook. You can recommend me, the host, to another podcast that you think I might be a good fit for so we can get the word out elsewhere. And you can just spread the word. It's a great way to keep the listenership growing as well. Oh, you can also leave a nice review on any platform that you use, whether it's iTunes, Google Play, et cetera, et cetera. Thank you very much for helping the show in whatever way you can. So wanted to tell you about Happy Place. I was looking at Jeff Weiss's latest selection of articles through the Weiss link, which he sends out every night. And recently there was a big thread of pieces on related to the Yayoi Kusama exhibit at the Broad Contemporary Museum in downtown LA, which most notably features the Infinity Rooms, which are these little rooms but have mirrors and lights installed in such a way that it seems infinite. And so you get to go into these rooms for, I think, 30 seconds is the maximum. To keep things moving, they keep it to 30 seconds. So there's been a lot of coverage of that. And, you know, it's this moment in selfie culture that has been going on for a while elsewhere in the Broad. And this seems to be the pinnacle or the apotheosis or the downfall or what have you, the breaking point of that. So meanwhile, there was another piece that Weisling picked up on, which is about a place in downtown LA that is having a limited run, and I'm not being advertised by them, by the way, called Happy Place, which appears to be geared for the selfie. There's a flower room where flowers come up from the ground as well as down from the ceiling. There is a room with smiley face M&M candies in yellow. There is a rubber ducky room, or maybe it's a Peeps room. I'm not sure which. There is an upside down furniture room, so I guess you can look like you're on the ceiling. There is a birthday cake room, and so on and so forth. It doesn't sound like the source for this is timeout.com, and it doesn't sound like they were too big on it. And when you add to that the admission of $28.50, I'm not sure how well they're going to do, unless it's people who are going to be covering the piece for various publications and they see it as an opportunity to get selfies and maybe get some traction that way. I don't know. But all this to say that I wonder if it's possible to visit a Yayoi Kusama Infinity Room and not take a selfie. Is that possible? Does anybody do that? I think everybody who is making sure that they get a good selfie, which I admit would probably be prone to do as well, is going to be missing out on the actual experience of being in that room. So if you have been in that room and you were able to either just take a selfie, just experience the room, or both, I would love to hear from you. So shoot us an email. We'll collect your emails and I will update everybody on what their experiences have been, whether it was in LA or elsewhere, because I know the Infinity Rooms have been having a run elsewhere in the country as well and perhaps beyond currently. So do let us know. I think that's it for this week, for these 2 weeks. Do reach out to us if you have any comments or questions, and thank you very much for listening. I appreciate it. I will talk to you in a couple of weeks. Ciao for now.